Thank you, Tom. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mary Sue Coleman, the President Emeriti of the University of Michigan, who retired last summer after 12 years as Michigan's 13th president. A native of Kentucky, her family moved to Cedar Falls, Iowa when she was 12. Following her degrees from Grinnell and her PhD in biochemistry from the University of North Carolina, she became involved in cancer research. She has served in various administrative capacities, including the University of Kentucky, Vice Chancellor at the University of North Carolina, Provost at the University of New Mexico, President for 7 years at the University of Iowa, and then she really went to the right school, 12 years at the University of Michigan. Under her leadership at Michigan, the university significantly expanded its research efforts and facilities, oversaw major new facility and renovation projects, and raised significant scholarship funds, in part the result of the proceeds from the largest successful fundraising campaign at any public university. Within the past year, President Coleman was the featured speaker at the Detroit Economic Club and also at the 63rd Annual Congressional Breakfast in Washington, D.C. In addition to her Board of Trustees roles that were indicated in her bio, she is also active in the Business Leaders for Michigan and is on the boards of directors of Johnson & Johnson and the Meredith Corporation. Please join me in a very warm welcome for President Coleman.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here today. Vern Istok has been asking me for several years to find time to be part of your program, and I'm thrilled finally to be here speaking with you. Is that okay? Better? Is that better? Okay. But I can't go any further without telling you what wonderful friends Vern and Judy Istok have been to their alma mater, the University of Michigan. They have been generous with their time and their money, and they are incredibly loyal. Our students benefit tremendously from their good work. Thank you, Vern and Judy. I really appreciate everything that you do for the University of Michigan. And we are thrilled to be here visiting with them in such a beautiful part of the country. A key factor in my being able to accept your invitation to speak today is the same reason that many of you are able to be here, retirement. Last July, I concluded 12 years as president of the University of Michigan, and that was preceded by 7 years as president of the University of Iowa. One of the questions I was often asked during my tenure and as it concluded was, did you ever always want to be a university president? My answer was, and is always the same, no. I never had any designs on being a university president. I trained as a biochemist, and my career goals were to carry out research in cancer to help understand that terrible disease. Noble work, I believed and continue to believe, but nowhere in the realm of managing an entire academic institution. In fact, it was being in the laboratory that led me to the administrative side of university life. I was a very happy faculty member at the University of Kentucky, ensconced in my research, when I was asked one day to step in an emergency as an administrator of the Cancer Center. My initial reaction was no. I didn't want to leave the lab, which I absolutely loved, just to push papers and attend meetings. University administration held little attraction for me. But after thinking about it for a while, I decided to give it a try. It was my first experience in administration, and one that eventually led to my being a dean, a provost, and president of two research universities. Today, I can't imagine any more rewarding work. I loved being president of Iowa and Michigan. I want to draw on those experiences and spend some time today sharing with you what I see as the challenges facing the modern university president, and by extension, facing all of those who support higher education and its place in American society. But I also want to leave time for plenty of questions, and I know this group will not be shy. The University of Michigan has had 14 presidents over nearly 200 years. I was the 13th. My husband, Ken, who is here today, liked to call me 13. And it was a very lucky number for me. The university's fourth president was a legal scholar by the name of Harry Hutchins. He was working at his desk one day when a custodian came into his office. In the course of his duties, the custodian told Hutchins that he found his work to be, I'm sorry to say, somewhat boring and thankless. Well, Theodora, President Hutchins said, I haven't had an easy time myself. I have my difficult problems. Yes, the custodian replied, but you have fun in it. And much of the time, it is incredibly fun and extremely rewarding to be president. No other nation can rival the innovation, creativity, and intellectual fervor of America's universities. None. Our institutions are responsible for America's knowledge security and intellectual well-being that advances health and medicine, business, social science, the arts, public policy, and national defense. But if I were to ask each of you what makes headlines in higher education today, I suspect the answers would not be positive. Intercollegiate athletics, sexual assault on campus, the cost of tuition, and the value of a diploma. My own list would include the globalization of education, new and emerging technologies that may enhance the educational experience, and access for students of all socioeconomic backgrounds. Our universities produce cures and treatments, create and share new knowledge, and send promising, talented graduates into the world. Not as exciting for the evening news, I know, but extremely important, and I'm going to comment more on that shortly. But let me touch first on some of the more challenging issues facing university presidents, not to mention parents, legislators, and alumni. As Michigan president, I traveled to numerous regions of the world to establish and expand academic partnerships. And wherever I went, be it Shanghai, Cape Town, São Paulo, Michigan alumni wanted to know about the football team. Intercollegiate athletics are a tremendous source of pride, not only for students and alumni, but also for entire states and regions. I love cheering for Michigan, and I was thrilled to see, in person as it happens, alumnus Tom Brady win the Super Bowl this weekend for the fourth time. Yes. And I know that Wolverines across the country felt the same way. At the same time, intercollegiate athletics will keep a college president awake at night. But this isn't a modern-day phenomenon. Well before Michigan had organized an organized football program, one that has grown into the winningest in NCAA history, our students were eager to compete. They pulled together a football team in the 1870s, and they challenged Cornell to a game. The students proposed a neutral game site in Cleveland, halfway between Ann Arbor and Ithaca. The president of Cornell, though, banned his students from playing, famously telling the Michigan president, I will not permit 30 men to travel 400 miles merely to agitate a bag of wind. Today, the pressure to compete and win is extraordinary. Competition for top coaches and first-rate facilities is an arms race. The University of Michigan has the largest stadium in the country and the highest paid football coach, at least as of today. Now, we can argue the merits of this, and many do. But one thing I've always been proud of at Michigan is the fact that intercollegiate athletics is entirely self-supported. Not $1 of tuition or taxpayer support goes to athletics. It's very important that this budget structure continue for two reasons. First, intercollegiate athletics should not be a drain on other university resources. And second, the revenue from football and men's basketball supports all other sports, and opportunities they provide for students. This includes swimming, gymnastics, baseball, softball, and many more. At Michigan, our athletics program pays all of its costs, including a robust capital construction program. Most impressive, the program also supports the entire university in the form of about $3.5 million a year to the general fund. We use those funds to support all students in the form of need-based financial aid and for recreational sports. Very few programs in the country do the same. Another complicated issue that is very much in the news today is sexual assault. We're hearing a lot these days about rape on campus. I do want to caution everyone from jumping to the conclusion that we have some sort of epidemic. We need to ask ourselves, are we seeing more of this behavior, or are students more comfortable coming forward about assaults because of greater awareness and support? Of course, this is a phone call that you never want as a parent or a president. Sexual assault is a horribly destructive experience on both sides, and we have worked hard at Michigan to raise awareness with the goal of preventing sexual misconduct. When I was president, I made the decision in 2004 to require that all incoming students receive prevention education. This was a decade before the federal government mandated the same, and I believe that our work at Michigan has made us a national model. We've worked to lessen the stigma of rape and to let students know that assaults will be addressed. Our educational outreach with students isn't a one-time thing just during freshman orientation. Rather, we approach this as a public health issue and administer doses of information throughout a freshman's first semester. This includes education about alcohol and other drugs, because we know from data that most sexual assaults, not all, but most, involve alcohol. It impairs judgment, it lowers inhibitions, and increases vulnerability. We also talk a lot about bystander intervention and give students skills for stepping in when something seems wrong. A few weeks ago, the university launched a campus-wide survey of students to assess sexual misconduct on campus. I understand that the response rate is more than 50%, which is staggering for survey work. The more, though, that we learn from students about their environment, the better we can address preventing assaults and assisting survivors. And we do want research to guide us. So now let me shift to the question of cost, access, and value. When people ask me what kept me awake at night as president, it was always how to keep Michigan affordable. American higher education, particularly public higher education, is one of the monumental achievements of the country. Last fall, when the Times Higher Education World University Rankings made their annual appearance, American universities dominated. Of the world's top 20 universities, 15 are in the United States. No other nation can rival the innovation, creativity, and intellectual fervor of America's universities. None. But we are threatened. We are threatened by shrinking financial support from our federal and state governments. We're threatened by waning public confidence in those skeptical of our value and our contributions. I believe that we must work to strengthen and preserve all universities, but I am really concerned about our great public universities. Our state and federal lawmakers, leaders in business and industry, our great philanthropic institutions all have a stake in the strength, the productivity, and the affordability of higher education. I've spent my entire career at public universities, from North Carolina, Kentucky, and New Mexico to Iowa and Michigan. In retirement, I continue to be deeply involved in the well-being of American higher education. In particular, I'm co-chairing the Lincoln Project, an initiative of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. We're the Lincoln Project because of President Lincoln's historic signing of the Morrill Act of 1862, which led to our extraordinary system of public universities. Today, though, we face unprecedented challenges. We cannot talk about the cost of tuition, and I know that many are concerned about the cost of tuition, without looking at the other side of the coin, that is diminished state and federal support. We have absorbed decades of declining state support. It always astonishes me that in 1970 in Michigan, the state supported 70% of educational expenses at the university. Today it supports about 16% and far less of the total university budget. In addition, almost no funding has been available in more than a decade for deferred maintenance or new capital projects. All of these forces at Michigan and elsewhere have left public research universities increasingly compromised in our mission to move America forward, and that's why we created the Lincoln Project. Great research universities have long sustained a dynamic and democratic America. We are essential to innovation, economic vitality, and educational opportunity. We represent America's single best mechanism for addressing income inequality. This is why the Lincoln Project is issuing a clarion call for a 21st century compact, one with federal and state governments, nonprofit institutions, business leaders, philanthropists, and families to revive, stabilize, and ultimately strengthen our public research universities. So here's what we want to accomplish. First, there must be an increased investment in America's top public research universities by state and federal governments. It is essential that states reinvest. Not doing so is short-sighted and threatens to cripple remarkable institutions of learning. Higher education budgets nationwide are starved. And if the rate of disinvestment of the past decades were to continue, we do face catastrophe in the not-so-distant future. State contribution to our public universities would start disappearing, that is, totally disappearing, in the year 2022, beginning with those in Colorado. That's less than a decade away. Federal support is even more critical when it comes to research universities. The United States can claim 35 of the world's top 50 research universities, but we face intense competition from other nations that seek economic advantage of strong research universities. Now, we're still dominant, the dominant country in terms of R&D performance, but that dominance is fraying at the edges. The U.S. share of global research spending declined from 39% in 1999 to just under 30% in 2011, according to the National Science Foundation. Contrast that with the R&D spending by Asian countries. Led by China, spending has grown from 25 to 34%. China alone has seen its share of R&D spending quadruple since 1999. This situation has a direct correlation with the second objective of the Lincoln Project. We must develop new partnerships between corporations and private industry that result in direct financial support for public research universities. To remain globally competitive, American business has a vested interest in the talent and research embodied in higher education. As employers of our graduates, business leaders must advocate for strong, consistent funding of higher education. We've had this conversation in Michigan now for several years, and it has led to a new way of thinking. The Business Leaders of Michigan is a private organization partnering with our three research universities to help reignite the Michigan economy. When our state was going through the worst of the Great Recession, these executives pushed for increasing our state investment in higher education from its status of 38th in the nation to the top 10. To make college more affordable and to make our state competitive in the global marketplace, Michigan's business leaders made it clear. We need a long-term commitment from the state to make higher education a higher priority in the budget. And what a difference this has made with our state lawmakers who are beginning to reverse the trend of disinvestment. We have a long way to go, but this collective voice of business support is encouraging, and it is very powerful. A third goal of the Lincoln Project is multifaceted and addresses aspects of higher education in the 21st century that I feel particularly passionate about. As universities, we must build partnerships and collaborations while also being as efficient as possible in our operations as major organizations. Private support for universities is no longer a luxury, but a necessity. Philanthropy has always been the cornerstone of America's private universities. The culture of giving back to one's alma mater is ingrained in students at private schools from their first days on campus. Public universities must also look to alumni and friends for support, and particularly for scholarships. I will promise you, today's public university presidents spend just as much of their time fundraising as private colleagues do. At the same time, though, when we turn to alumni and philanthropists, universities have an obligation to control costs. And that's challenging, because what we do is inherently expensive. We're people-intensive and high-tech in our approach, but we have to be willing constantly to assess our processes to ensure quality and value. In Michigan, though, any time that we reduce spending, and we've been doing it every year for the last 12 years, it comes with a pledge to protect the academic core of the institution. And we made many cuts. We eliminated or consolidated hundreds of jobs. We centralized classroom utilization to assure every new building was completely justified. We asked employees to pay more for their health care, including many other things that we've done. Only one budget item was sacrosanct in this whole process, and that was financial aid. Here we added dollars. The result is that for many of our low and middle-income resident students, it actually costs less to attend Michigan today than it did in 2004, and their loan burdens are lower than in previous years. We've also learned to make better use of our resources, both fiscal and intellectual, by working with strong partners. In Michigan, we look to our fellow research universities in the state to leverage our collective strengths. The University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and Wayne State University began collaborating seriously in 2006 by forming the University Research Corridor to draw upon the talents of our faculty. At first, it didn't feel natural, yet the leaders of all three universities felt it was essential for the good of our state, and it works. Today, Michigan's University Research Corridor ranks upon the country's top university research regions in terms of research expenditures, intellectual property disclosures, patent applications, and new business startups. And our faculty are working closer together than ever before. As some of the world's great public universities, Florida, Michigan, and others fulfill the promise of teaching, research, and service. More important, we have never wavered in our extraordinary compact with society, especially the citizens of our state. We hold our doors open for students of all backgrounds, all incomes, all cultures. We work on society's behalf to promote the greater good. It is an obligation that we feel privileged to fulfill, and we do so with innovative research, answers to complex questions, and talented alumni. This isn't the first time that we as presidents and as institutions have faced difficult times. We can all point to challenging eras of dwindling resources, campus crises, the pressure of athletics, and more. And yet we persevere because our mission is so profound. Clark Kerr, the former president of the University of California, who did so much to define public higher education in the latter half of the 20th century, rightly observed, "As society goes, so goes the university, but also, as the university goes, so does society." The progress of knowledge remains so central to the progress of civilization. It's quite simple for me. Our collective progress and prosperity hinge on higher education. The onus is on all of us, not just university presidents. All of us, elected officials, business leaders, philanthropists, parents, and retirees, must collaborate on effective answers. And I welcome being part of this national conversation. My time as university president may be done, but as an educator and a firm believer and universities, I am hard at work. And I trust together that we will see that America's universities, its public universities especially, are powerful, productive, and globally relevant in the 21st century. Thank you very much, and now I welcome your questions.
Mary Sue, that was terrific. Thank you for your clarity, your persuasiveness, and insightfulness. These are two books that hopefully will remind you of
your
Marco Island and Naples. I'll put them on the
Okay,
table.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you.
I also think you struck some nerves in this group because I've never seen so many questions.
Oh, good. This is what I like.
There were so many questions, I'm not sure where to even start.
Yeah.
But let's start with this one.
Okay.
It was on the minds of several people.
Okay.
Why are the Ivy, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia so liberal? Please comment on why most professors are very liberal. Please comment on affirmative action. What is your position with the ever-increasing instances of speakers at universities being shouted down?
Mm-hmm.
Are you concerned about the very liberal leaning of the vast majority of college facilities? And many graduates leave the campus preferring socialism to democracy and capitalism.
Okay.
If so, why?
I get it.
You get the idea?
I get it. Okay, so let me start with what I think is, Tom and I talked a little bit about this during lunch, and I think it's a very important issue. I mean, one of the reasons that I love being president of the University of Michigan is, first of all, it's a place that has national impact. It's a place that has been led by very wise people for a large number of years, and so I was privileged to be part of that sequence of people leading the institution. And what impressed me immediately in going to Michigan was that it has long had what I considered one of the most effective policies in the country for bringing in controversial speakers. So we have a very, very ingrained plan at the university. And it's not that we don't want to encourage students to speak out and to make their opinions known. But before every single, in fact, we have this printed in all the programs of our speakers that there are acceptable forms of protest and there are unacceptable forms of protest. We have a very well-defined policy. We designate somebody at every speech that is there to read the policy and to let people know that they will have three warnings about being carried out. The first warning, you need to sit down and be quiet. You can hold a sign. You can't shout down a speaker. You have a second warning. You have a third warning. You're taken out. And very well, everybody understands the policy. During all my time at Michigan, I never had anybody carried out of a meeting. I felt like the university did it well. We endured a lot of criticism from a lot of sources when we had controversial speakers on both sides. When I first went to the university, my first thing that I had to confront was a student group that invited a very radical Palestine Liberation Organization to have their annual meeting at Michigan. And I knew that the guy who was coming to speak was under federal investigation for being a terrorist. And yet, because the students had gone through the whole process, they'd done it right, I insisted that conference be held. If we had to assign a public safety officer for every person in the conference, we were going to have it. We were not going to shut it down. And we had it. And it was civil, and it was not awful. And so I just think it's extraordinarily important that we don't give in to the mob and say we're not going to hear people speak. We can disagree. And I firmly believe that, the antidote to speech you don't like is more speech and more rational discussion. So I was proud of what Michigan did. I'm not proud of what some of my colleagues have done at other places.
Please explain why there are so many women college and university presidents. It is now well over 50%.
I don't think it's well over 50%. I have to tell you, I think the high water mark, at least in the AAU, was the Association of American Universities, which are the top public and private research university. I don't think the number's ever gone over 20%. So it's, I'm proud of the fact that the presidency is open to people from all backgrounds and
And it's becoming more and more common. And I think some of my women colleagues have done a fabulous job.
You're supposed to say, because it's an easy job.
Yeah, right. I get asked often, well, isn't it harder for you as a woman? And I said, look, this is a hard job for men and women. It's equally hard for men and women. So forget that. I mean, you know, this is you don't get a pass. You don't get it. It isn't harder for women.
Today's Wall Street Journal reports America is not producing enough young scientists. If so, what can be done?
Yeah, this is a big issue that has been discussed, you know, for a long time. And STEM education is extremely important. I think we're doing a lot of things to help, and I think we're encouraging a lot more people into the fields. I'll tell you one big success story. Bill Gates decided to go out around university campuses about a decade ago and speak about the need for computer scientists because we were not producing enough computer scientists. He came to Michigan as one of his trips. And, you know, then this whole sequence started with high schools trying to encourage people to go into computer science. We are bursting at the seams now with computer scientists. So this is possible to do. I'm happy that many high schools are now really encouraging young women, particularly to go into science, because we don't have enough young men to fulfill all the need. We need to get everybody we can interested in science, and I think we're going to have an impact. But we have to have better preparation in K-12, or it's not going to work in the universities, because you can't come to college and make up for deficits in your education in high school. You just can't do it. But I do think that there's a lot more activity now. I'm happy to see that.
What is your opinion on free junior college education? Not sure I can read all that.
Yeah.
What is your view on online universities?
This
relates to a lot of questions about university costs and how are you going to keep them down?
Those are two big questions. So you know, I think there are a lot of questions surrounding the president's initiative on virtually free community college. I think it will depend on the circumstance. Number one, I'm happy that there is an emphasis on making college affordable. That is really important. I may not agree with the specifics, but I agree with trying to open the doors of access to young people to get more education. In a place like California that has an extraordinarily well-developed community college system where there are easy transfer rates to Cal State and the University of California, in fact, you may be surprised to know that almost 50% of the graduating students at Berkeley come through the community college system. It's astonishing what they've done, and it's been very, very effective. In some other places in the country, it's not so successful because they don't have good coordination. If you've got a good coordination, that might be a good approach. If you don't, it's going to be a disaster. So I think it's a complex issue, but I'm happy about that. Okay, online. Online is in its infancy, and in some niches, I think it works well. If somebody needs a certificate or they need a fast program, they've got a full-time job, they can't locate at a campus, it can be very effective. And the software is getting better. The interactivity is getting better. But for me, having a person in the classroom, a teacher, is always better if you can do that. Because I think that interaction with a teacher, it often becomes a mentor with other students, is extraordinarily important. But we now use hybrid approaches. At the University of Michigan, we've got lots of online components of classes. They work extremely well. So we'll see it get better. It's not inexpensive. I mean, the stuff that we do online in Michigan is actually more expensive than putting a professor in the classroom. So it's not going to solve the cost problem. I think the cost problem is more complex. And one of the reasons that I was talking about a new compact is we have to get many ways to tackle the problem. We know that the cost curve the trajectory of tuition cost has to moderate. The cost at the university is actually below the CPI, the increase. The problem is we've had huge disinvestment from the state, so one of our revenue sources is going way down, and we haven't been able to make up the difference by keeping tuition flat. But we've had moderate increases at Michigan, and I'm proud that we've been able to do that, coupled with a lot of financial aid that makes it possible for students to come to Michigan.
In line with your comments, it appears the universities are endeavoring to cover up sexual violence on campus, binge drinking, et cetera, in order to protect enrollments. What policy should they adopt to stop the violence, such as what was done recently in Dartmouth? And can you talk about the future of the Greek system at Michigan?
Sure. So So I think it's a bum rap to say that universities are afraid of their reputations and they're trying to cover up sexual assault. I've never tried to cover up sexual assault at Michigan. It is a terrible, terrible issue. And it's equally for the young man and the young woman. I mean, these are both our students, and we care about all of them. It's not that we're trying to protect one on the other. So it's a difficult problem. It's also a very difficult problem because until recently, until there's been more conversation about this, many women were afraid, did not want to come forward, would not come forward, might come forward in the beginning, but then didn't want to do anything. And the standards in the courts are so high that if this is turned over to prosecutors all the time, it's likely that nothing will ever be done because the evidentiary standards in U.S. courts of law, perhaps rightly so, are very high. So I think the best thing that we can do, I welcome the discussions. I welcome the fact that this is an issue that we need to address. There are no simple answers. We're going to do more education. I know the president of Dartmouth really well because he was my provost, and he and I have talked about it a lot. He was an alum of Dartmouth, so he knows the issues. We have to have better ways to educate about alcohol. We have to reduce alcohol use on campus. You all understand that it's relatively prevalent. And the most, in my experience, the most times that there is a problem is when both parties are drinking alcohol into excess. And so we've got to do a better job of helping students make good choices. We can't control what happens all the time, but we can help educate and we can help provide support and help have a better experience for students in college.
Have you done anything to stop the trend to have professors teach fewer hours?
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have a question. Do you agree with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has agreed that university professors should work harder to mm-hmm. ameliorate funding problems?
Yeah. So let me tell you the conundrum there. I was a professor, and I never worked harder in my life than I was a professor. It is extraordinarily difficult to teach well, to prepare well, to spend all the time that you spend in between your lectures, counseling students, talking to students, at least in science, working on projects with students. This is a demanding job, and I certainly never felt like that. And my husband's a political scientist, and he did the same. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't take teaching seriously and that we shouldn't make sure that all of our professors are engaged in teaching. But we have two other missions in the university that are really important, the research mission and the service mission. And many of our professors, they all have to do all three, so they can't spend their time exclusively on one or the other. I think we make enormous demands on them, but we always need to be careful about the teaching and being sure that people are teaching the appropriate numbers of classes is an important issue that we all deal with. I will tell you, though, for many of you who don't realize, and I sit on the board of a major scientific company, Johnson & Johnson. Over the last decade, most of the major research development-focused companies in this country have quit doing their research internally. So they basically outsource it to the university. So if we're going to have new discoveries and if we're going to have innovations, if they don't come from the universities, they're not going to come from anywhere. And so it's this role that we take on very seriously. I think we do it extraordinarily well. The University of Michigan does over $1 billion of research a year, from NASA all the way to the Defense Department, to the NIH, to NSF, to you name it, we do it. And a lot of that research gets picked up and commercialized and helps the U.S. economy. So I don't want that to go away either. I mean, I think we have to balance it all. Yep. Oh, fraternities at Michigan. Okay, I Byrne's favorite question, as he is the president of his national fraternity. So one of the things I caution is extremism on either side.
I didn't write that question.
I know you didn't. We need to throw the fraternities off campus to the fraternities are perfect. I mean, these are the two ends of the spectrum. Somewhere in between, we're going to find the right answer. And yes, there's been bad behavior in fraternities, but yes, fraternities do a tremendous job, and it's a great way to find connections on campus.
I paid her to say that.
And I want to preserve what is the best, but we need to know, to let the kids know that when they misbehave, there will be consequences. And we had a terrible situation that Byrne knows about at Michigan where over the holidays, a number of our fraternity members went up to Northern
and
Michigan.
Sororities.
and did, you know, fueled by alcohol, once again, did a lot of damage to a ski resort, a lot of damage. And we, they okay, you know, you make the mistake, you're going to pay for it. Not just pay, not to get mommy and daddy to write a check, but you're going to pay in other ways because this is not leaders invest. This is not what Michigan students do. And so that, if we hold firm to that and help counsel students, then I think we'll get to a place where we need to be. But I don't want fraternities and sororities to go away. I want them to do the great work that they do, and we know they do, and create lifetime friendships that are really important.
As an educator, what is your opinion about the Common Core curriculum for the public K through 12 schools?
Oh dear, I am not an expert in K through 12. That's for sure. We do have the best education dean in the country. Her name is Deborah Ball, and she's a mathematician. And she has, you know, whether it's Common Core or whatever it is, she does believe that standards are extremely important and that you have to really work on math education and science and math, and this is one way to do it. I will note that I believe the Common Core was developed by governors, actually, of the state, and it was pretty bipartisan approach, and somehow it's gotten a bad rap recently. So I don't know the details, but I certainly am in favor of rigorous standards for education in the K through 12 that are pretty uniform across the country. I mean, you can have different ways of getting there, but you need to make sure that your students are well prepared before they come to college. We're not going to do any remedial work at Michigan. If you're not prepared, you're not going to get in. And so that's just, you know, it's too bad, but that's the way it is. And I think that's the way more universities should be approaching this to help reform K through 12.
President Wheeler is giving me the high sign,
okay.
But I do have to ask one question, which I don't expect her to answer. It's David Rissmiller's question. Mm-hmm. Were you ever concerned that your football coach could earn more money than you?
Well, since my football coach has always earned more money than I have, I don't worry about it. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
thank you for all your questions.
Thank you.
Great job. Great job. Do you want to give a benediction or no?
No.
There is no benediction.
Yeah.